they were frustrated by the fact that people had such a narrow definition of creativity. So they researched about the different types of creative acts, and they found there's actually four different types of creative acts.
All right, welcome back to Insights by Design, episode 6. We're very lucky to have Ali Torben joining us today. Michael, how are you? Did you have a good week?
I am still freezing cold. You know, we live in one of the hottest states in the United States, and I cannot survive this Arctic blast. So I'm here in my sweater. I'm just trying to survive.
And Ali, how are you doing today?
I am swell, swell and dandy. And I am enjoying the warm weather, which I think is probably similar to you guys. It's 60 degrees here in the DC area, which is actually warm for us. So I am enjoying the warmth.
I love it. Yeah, the East Coast is a whole other ballgame when it comes to winter weather. You know, in Colorado, it's dry. And so, like, the cold really doesn't feel that cold. You still have people in shorts out jogging in, like, minus 10.
Oh, wow.
But the East Coast is insane. It's got that humid, biting cold. No, thank you.
Yes. Yep. A lot of humidity up and down the coast. Because I live in just south of D.C. in Virginia, and there's tons of humidity here.
Mm-hmm. Is that where you're from originally?
Not really. My parents were in the Navy, so just kind of all over. I went to high school in Southern Virginia, though, because my dad retired when we were stationed down in Norfolk. So I do feel like Virginia is my home because I stayed here. I went to college at JMU, that's in Harrisonburg, and then I started working for government clients in the DC area right after. So I would say Virginia is definitely my home, but I wouldn't say I grew up here.
I love it. Wonderful. Well, we're so happy to have you. Your new book, Chart Spark, is incredible. Yes, it's really good. And I hope we can talk a little bit about it, maybe your process and some of the key learnings from it today. And just getting started, for those who don't know you, do you mind just giving a little bit of your background and introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, of course. I'm Ali Torben, and I am a senior data literacy advocate at Data Literacy Training Company based in Seattle. But like I said, I'm in the DC area. And I am an information designer, data visualization designer. I host the podcast DataViz Today. Just wrote the book ChartSpark. But my background, I have a math degree and a graduate certificate in geospatial intelligence. So I started my career, like I said, in working for government clients here in the DC area. And it was very much like data analyst running SQL queries all day. And I always felt there was kind of something missing, but I didn't know what that was. But then when I started having kids, I stopped working completely for about a year. And I thought, okay, this is the time I'm going to figure out what I want to do. And I was looking just for jobs that I could do from home that had used my data background. And I found this thing called data journalism, so freelance data journalism. So I wrote some articles for a local magazine where I was like doing some data analysis, like making isochrones on a map and figuring out how much more expensive it was to live within walking distance of a metro. So like those kinds of things. So they were leaning into my skills and people were interested in it. So I started doing that and realized there's this thing called data visualization. And I started listening to podcasts about it, but I didn't really know how to get in the field. Like I realized how little I actually knew about it. So I was like, okay, I'll just start interviewing people on a podcast. I'll make my own podcast and kind of go to the source and figure out how to make visualizations, what the process is. So I did that, started that in 2018. And by interviewing people and then creating my own work, I was able to create a portfolio and actually get hired as a DataViz designer. So I've been doing data visualization design for various clients. I went freelance for a few years, and then I still do freelance data visualization design, but like I said, also work for data literacy, training people in data storytelling, data literacy fundamentals, and yeah, just doing a whole bunch of stuff. So that's, yeah, from beginning to end.
I love it. That's so interesting.
So for those of us who are kind of new to the field, Ali, how would you define words like data viz and data literacy? Because usually we use the word literacy to refer to reading and writing.
Right.
But when we're talking about data, what are we talking about?
Yeah, great point, because I didn't really know the difference either when I started working for data literacy, because I knew I was really good with the data visualization stuff and also just data stuff in general. And it's kind of like, what's that saying where a fish doesn't realize it's in water? Like when you are already in data stuff, you don't really realize what things people don't really get. So learning the data literacy fundamentals course that Ben Jones, the CEO of Data Literacy, has developed, and then I'm teaching it, I realized all these things that we take for granted that most people don't really know. So like things like scale types, like a categorical variable where you can put things in different categories, like nominal and ordinal. So you have a nominal variable, like something that doesn't need to be in any kind of order, like just names of things, like names of animals, like a dog, a cat, a horse, you know. One's not better than the other one, but you just put things in groups. So those kinds of things where we take them for granted, we kind of already understand them because we're putting them in spreadsheets all day and analyzing them. But other people who aren't in the data field don't really know what's the difference, why we need to know the difference, why you might want to convert one data scale type to another, all those things.
Okay, so it sounds like data literacy has a big terminological aspect, like what do you even call things? Mm-hmm. And then I hear you suggesting that another part of data literacy is how do you make decisions about what you want to see or what sorts of questions right. you need answered. So there's a strategic side as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you need to know what's meaningful, what's not meaningful, data pitfalls, you know, is this a percent change or are these percentage points? You know, like all those things that you say, and then also like what's the nuance behind them and when you use each one and when you would use the other one. It's all important.
Gotcha. And then what about data visualization or data viz? Is that just bar charts and bar charts and circle charts all day long?
Well, so data visualization, yeah, I would define that as charts, all the different chart types. And you have bar charts, line charts, pie charts, but also information design. I have found myself moving more into that area. So like, for example, yesterday I was helping a charity who collects donor money for research to help with neurological diseases. And they wanted to create a graphic that would help doctors decide which differential diagnosis to make, because there's a lot of different types of atypical Parkinson diseases. So, you know, you might have this type of symptom and this type of symptom. Okay, so what could it be? And they had like a very complicated infographic to show this information. And they're like, the doctors are just confused and not reading this. So how do you design this information so that it's easier for someone to read? So I really just created a really nice table with check marks in between them. So people could see just at a glance what symptom would lead someone to believe that this disease was associated with it. So I would say that you can think about data visualization in a narrow way where it's just different charts. You can also think about infographics, which I would say is more information design. So sometimes that includes charts, but a lot of it is things like, you know, big numbers or illustrations or information design. So you can think about like Venn diagrams or charts or tables, those kinds of things. So it is kind of a pretty big field.
Gotcha.
And you're speaking Michael's language. Michael has a PhD in technical communication. So we get over, we discuss information design a lot.
Yeah.
But where we've found a lot of traction is we focus on data as a product. And then the design aspect really is to drive the outcomes, just like you described with like, what's the outcome that this charity really wanted? What did they need the information to do? Who's the target market? And then what's the way that, what information should this target market interact with? And what's the best way for them to interact with it?
Right. Yeah. The audience, their goals, and not having too many goals. I mean, I'm sure you've seen that. That's a really common pitfall. Like, we want this to grab attention. We want them to be able to make a huge decision on this. And we want this, that, and the other. And you're like, well, you're really asking one chart to do a lot of things. So good luck. So yeah, being focused on like one thing at a time. And then maybe if you can get a secondary goal in there, that's just icing on the cake. But yeah, being really focused on one goal for one audience.
100%. You've probably seen this as a consultant where I try to stay away from wants because, like Henry Ford said, if he asked people what they wanted, they would have asked for a faster horse. Like, you've got to focus on like, what do you need? And then us as consultants can use our background and understanding of the available landscape to give you the best option to meet your needs. But often with stakeholders, especially with like charts, anytime somebody comes to me with a solution, immediately red flags go off for me because they're like, build me this. I'm like, well, then build it yourself because I'm here to, you know, tell me what you need. What are you trying to accomplish? Why do we want to accomplish it? What's the impact of us not accomplishing it? Let me build a solution for you.
Because they have made so many decisions, right? By the time they give you a chart that they want you to just build, they've pretty much made all the decisions already. And now you're just, you know, pushing buttons in a chart. And the hard work, I think, comes before that, before the pressing the buttons in the charting tool. It's all that stuff we were talking about, asking the right questions. What needs to be different after the person reads this chart? Like, what are they supposed to be able to know? What are they supposed to be able to do? What do you want them to feel even? Those are all important things that will guide all which direction you go in with the chart. Or maybe you don't use a chart at all, right? It's especially true with maps. It's like whenever we have, if you have data with a city or a state or something, people are like, oh, let's just make a map because we have it. Well, you know, maybe, but maybe not.
Exactly.
So we're talking about information design. Design is both a noun, meaning the chart or the final deliverable, as well as a verb, the process of getting there, understanding those stakeholder needs and helping them see a better solution, hopefully, than just a faster horse or whatever the project is. But Ali, you're an expert in creativity, and some of us just aren't that creative, or at least we don't think we are. And so we're hoping we could talk to you a little bit about what creativity is. Can it be developed, or is it hopeless? How can it apply to our various job titles? So we've defined data viz and data literacy. What is creativity?
Yeah, it's a great question, and one that I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, because if you were to ask me maybe 2 years ago, before I started really focusing in on creativity, what is creativity? I might have said it was like maybe some sort of artistic ability, or just your ability to like think outside the box. You know, I think those are kind of the trite things that we say normally when you think about creativity, or maybe even just doing something different. You know, you did something different and wild, therefore that's creative. And I think all three of those things are incomplete. So I would say creativity is the ability to generate new ideas or remix existing ideas that are useful. So I think important things in that definition are it's an ability. So something that you can do and you can hone this skill. It's not something you're born with. It's not an identity. Maybe you consider it an identity, but it doesn't have to be. I think focus it more on it as an ability, like your ability to do math problems, right? Like, you wouldn't say that I can or can't do math. Maybe you say I don't like math, but that's something different, right? You cannot like doing creative things, but it doesn't mean that you can't. So it's an ability, and also the idea needs to be new and useful. So it's not that it's just new. It should also be useful. And the thing is, it's not that it has to be new and useful to the entire world. That's great. But if it's just new and useful to you, that is still creative. So you just learn how to create a bar chart in Tableau. That has been done hundreds of thousands of times already by other people. But if that's the first time that you have done it, and now the skill that you have is useful for you, that was new and useful to you. And that was still a creative act. And in my book, I talk about, there was this research by Kaufman and Baghetto, and they were frustrated by the fact that people had such a narrow definition of creativity. So they researched about the different types of creative acts, and they found there's actually four different types of creative acts. And we have the mini C, little C, pro C, and big C. So big C is like, you know, the Einstein level, leaves a mark on humanity kind of creative acts. And I think in our heads that that's our standard most of the time, where, well, I don't consider myself creative because I'm not Einstein. I'm not changing the world. So that's big C. And I don't think we should really be worrying too much about that, because, you know, there's like a lot of luck and other stuff involved with that. So like, just forget about that. Mini C is the example I was just saying, where, you know, you learn how to create a chart in Tableau. That is still a creative act. And then we have little C, where maybe you're experimenting, doing things new and useful to you still, but maybe it's useful to other people, maybe not. So like, I continue to create charts in Tableau, and I learn how to put a bar chart and a map on one dashboard, and they filter in at the same time. And that's new and useful to me. And maybe, you know, my colleague can use that as well. That's a creative act. And then there's pro C creative acts, and that's our creative acts that we do professionally. So maybe I have gotten so good at Tableau, I put together this dashboard for my team, and everybody uses it, and it, you know, saves the team time and money. And that's a creative act. So you can see how all these little acts build on each other. And when you redefine creativity in that way, it feels really approachable, right? It's not like, oh, I had to just jump in and save the world. I did all these little things, all these little creative acts. I learned things. I experimented. I collaborated with other people. I'm creative. So I feel like this definition is very liberating.
I love it. I love your focus on utility, new and useful. Because often, like on the Tableau Viz of the Day or Tableau Public Gallery, there's so many beautiful charts that aren't useful at all.
Yeah.
Like there's insane Sankey diagrams, which I would never use in a professional setting. I was thinking about that this morning in preparation for this discussion. I think a lot of times new analysts especially will get focused on these very impressive, very quote unquote creative visualizations that lack utility. And it's almost like a fashion show, where like fashion shows are very extreme, and they're really extreme examples of trends. And then when the actual fashion rolls out, it's much more approachable. So when we look at like Tableau Public Gallery and we see these extreme examples of visualizations, that's not what's being used in production. And that's not, if you can't do that, that doesn't mean you're not creative. But maybe it inspires you to use something more appropriate.
I love that metaphor, comparing it to the fashion shows, because you're so right. But you have to know the difference. You have to point that out and know, okay, I am not making that in my dashboard. I maybe will take a piece of that, or maybe me creating this wild dashboard that looks like something, you know, for a fashion show, the fashion show equivalent of a data visualization. Me doing that taught me a new skill. I think that's the big thing. It's going to teach me a new skill. I was able to experiment with a few different things so that I can pick a couple of those skills and then apply it to my work. And maybe it helps me connect some dots in my day-to-day practical work that I wouldn't normally have done.
And I love that focus on both tools and skills in the creative process. Because I work with UX students. And sometimes I think they kind of focus on that big C creativity. And they think that to generate something new and useful, it has to be like Venus exploding from the head of Jupiter, just something totally unexpected, unanticipated, and something new in the world. While I've noticed that a lot of people, creative people who work in either creative industries or tech industries, are very good at remixing and blending stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to mistell the story, so don't sue me, James Cameron. But apparently when James Cameron wanted to pitch the hit film Avatar, he just went into his producers and said something like, Titanic meets Fern Gully, and then sat down.
Oh.
And you can see it. You know, it's not just, I mean, it is a very original idea, very original execution. But he was blending different genres, different tools, different skill sets that he already had. Mm-hmm. And I think for those of us who work outside of the film industry, there's a lesson for us about creativity there. If you build your skills, if you build your tools, you can get better at remixing stuff, blending stuff, moving laterally, and seeing what we come up with.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love Fern Gully, so I can see how that worked out. But I actually did back in 2020, I did a personal project for 100 days. I would design a wallpaper that I imagined a database designer would like back going from year to year, from 1920 to 2020. So in 1920, what would a database designer wallpaper look like? So I was remixing these ideas. So what was the fashion or the graphic design elements that were happening in 1920? I pulled elements from, I was looking at New Yorker magazine covers for that inspiration. And then I would take a chart type and I would mix them together and put it into a wallpaper design. And I did that every day for 100 days. And that creativity, that creative act of remixing like that created some really cool looking wallpapers. I mean, and that was cool, but it also helped me be more creative in my day-to-day work, figuring out, okay, well, I want someone to have this particular feeling in this infographic that I'm making. I'm going to pick this color palette because I know from making all these other wallpapers that this particular feeling people really like, or this color palette people resonate with. So it taught me a lot of skills that I was able to take into my practical work doing like these remixing experiments.
And with the tools and abilities growing, and a lot of times the foundational principles of data visualization or information design stay the same, but we become more efficient in it. AI is really rolling out and helping us be more efficient in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
What role do you see AI playing in creativity in information design?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's becoming more and more clear that your ability to use a software is going to be less and less important. And I was starting to feel that when I was a data analyst, and I was just thinking like, I don't feel like I'm valued for my ideas. I'm just valued for like, you know, typing in some SQL queries. And you can see how like in ChatGPT, I needed to create a calculation in Tableau. I didn't really need to be that good at Tableau. I just described what my data was and what I needed to do. And it told me exactly what to do step by step, which calculations to put in where. Like, okay, make this calculation and name it this, and then, you know, paste this in. And I was just following instructions, and I was able to create something really cool with, you know, not really knowing how to use the tool that well. So I think our ability to use tools is going to be less and less important. And our ability to think and develop new ideas and also make them meaningful to other people, that is going to be a really, really important and meaningful skill for the future. And we can also use AI, ChatGPT, for the creativity part too. So a lot of the prompts that I have in my book are prompts as in like not traditional like ChatGPT prompts, but like things to get you thinking. So answer these set of questions and then, you know, pull out these answers and then think about it like this. And it helps you think of your project in different ways and how to transform it into a more meaningful angle for your reader. And you can use ChatGPT to help you brainstorm with these questions. But the thing is, ChatGPT's answers are not, you know, you have to filter through them. You know, it's not a human, so it doesn't know what's actually meaningful to other humans. Only we know that. And that's the thing that nobody can take away from us. And maybe it's going to get better at it, but being able to kind of have a good sense of, okay, this is the data set. I'm going to ask these questions. Maybe ChatGPT is going to give me some answers to help me brainstorm, but I am ultimately going to be the one to decide, okay, this is the meaningful angle that I'm going to present to my audience, because I know them. I'm sitting next to Bob every day. I know it's important to him. So I think that it's mostly going to be the asking the questions and deciding what's meaningful is the thing that's going to be the more important part in the future rather than just knowing how to use a software tool.
I completely agree. And I'm glad you brought up your book, because your book is structured in such a helpful and unique way that I think it's a really great time for it to come out for information design professionals, for data analysts to really start thinking about this skill set. Could you tell us a little bit about how your book is structured? And you mentioned the prompts, but maybe tell us a little bit more if somebody's thinking like, oh, I do need to develop that skill set, mm-hmm. how could Allie's book help me do that?
Yeah, I tried to take a holistic approach to creativity and data visualization, a holistic and practical, I guess you could put it. Because when you are reading about how to be more creative, there's not really anything for our field. It's more of like creativity for artists or illustration, or maybe just like general creativity. Because I read a lot of books about creativity, but I kind of felt like a lot of them were kind of woo-woo. You know? And some of that stuff lands, but I don't know. For a lot of data-minded people like me, it was just kind of like, all right, well, how does that convert to a more effective graphic? I don't know. I couldn't really connect the dots. So I took the things that were useful to me in those books and I kind of pushed it through my lens. So things like you hear a lot, people say, oh, go take a rest, go for a walk, go be more creative. All those things are important, but how does that actually integrate in your day-to-day? So I broke up the book into three sections. We have care. So how do you actually care for your creativity? So those are things like you need to have an open mind. You need to collect your inspiration in a really specific way so that you actually use it, those kinds of things. And then you also need to communicate your creativity and coax it out. So I have two more sections called coax and communicate. So coaxing is things like brainstorming, seeing your project in a new way, kind of blasting through project paralysis so that you don't feel like you're stuck, like, oh, I'm not inspired, so I don't know how to start this project. Like, what are some things that you can do to actually get started? How can you effectively communicate your ideas? So things like metaphor, using visual metaphors to really lean on someone's understanding of something else so that you can explain your new concept in an easier way. So I set it up so that each chapter I have a personal example and then I have a prompt, so an exercise that people can do, and then summarize the chapter and ways that they can use this prompt in their own work. So that I try to make it as short as possible because I don't like reading a lot of fluffy books. So that was kind of my approach when I was writing the book. It's like, okay, how can I be as succinct as possible and just give people enough information so they can read it, understand what I'm saying, and then go and apply it to their own work.
I love it. Your book has been very helpful and I've just been started reading it. I haven't finished it, but I feel like it's more like a use it as you go book as I've dove into it. So I've got some new analysts on my team who are working on some creative projects, but and we're rolling out a new software to a new set of stakeholders who haven't experienced some visual communication before. They've mostly been getting Excel reports. And this analyst is very creative, and that's her path. Like, she loves creating beautiful visualizations that communicate effectively. And I think I'm going to get her your book, because as she's been working with these stakeholders, sometimes she does run up into some of these questions that your prompts would help a lot with.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't want to give her the answers, because then, as you said, then she's just using the software. She's not working through that process. So I've been trying to think, like, how could I help her work through this process more helpfully?
Right.
And sometimes I'll ask her a good question, but usually I'm not asking her good questions. So to inspire her. And I'm like, I should just get her Allie's book. And I think I'm going to do that. Because as you described it, I'm like, this is exactly what we need.
Yeah, it is hard too, because it's not an efficient process. Creativity is very inefficient. And I think that's a hard part, especially for data-oriented people. We're used to being productive. We're used to like knowing the answer or knowing how to find the answer. It's like, okay, I just have to keep working on it and then I'll find it. But with creativity, you're by definition doing something new. So you're taking a new path and, you know, a lot of times you take that path and then there's a roadblock and that road's closed and then you got to go back and try something else. So inherently it's inefficient. And I think we think that means we're doing it wrong, but we're not. Being inefficient, that's part of the creative process. And that's like one of the negative aspects of creativity. But one of the positive aspects is that it can be exciting. It's transformative. You're going to eventually get to something that's innovative. And if you do something always the standard way, that's a positive because you feel productive and it's reliable and it's predictable. But, you know, the other thing that you're getting if you do that is that it's going to be boring. It's going to be rigid. You're not going to grow. You know, you're not going to have that innovation. So you do need to know that there's a difference. And if you know which way you're doing, you have to kind of set your expectations, and that will make it an easier road for you.
Well, I think you anticipated my next question, Ellie, because I was going to ask you, if creativity is an inefficient process, then how do we justify its return on investment? And you mentioned it's exciting. People like to be excited in the work that they do. It's transformative. It eventually leads to innovation.
Yeah.
But have you had to justify creativity or the training of creative professionals to people who don't understand the bigger vision? What are some arguments that data analysts or UXers could use to justify why they need to be more creative?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And as you can imagine, you do need someone in your team, like your manager, to believe in you. Like it sounds like you do, Andrew. It's like, well, I believe that this person can create some really amazing things with some guidance. And I think that having some sort of culture around in your team that doing things inefficiently sometimes is okay, but at the right time. So you don't always need a creative idea, right? So I have four questions in the book that I ask myself, either, you know, just myself, or I talk to my clients about. This could be something that you talk through with your manager, so that you can decide, okay, this is a good time for me to experiment with some inefficient routes because there might be some high return on the other side, or maybe this is a good time. Okay, let's just go with what works. Cause I know that a lot of the pushback just comes from, let's say this person on your team, Andrew, is just like, I'm just like doing whatever. I like being creative. And you're just like, but we need to deliver. Like, stop doing what you're doing, like just deliver it. So that could be really, that's really frustrating for everybody. So if you talk through these questions first, then it kind of orients everybody pointing towards the same target. It's like, yes, okay, this is a good time. We can experiment a little bit. No, this is not a good time. So I can tell you the questions that I run through. So the first one is, how much time does the reader of the graphic have? So if this is like you're on your morning commute and you're looking through the newspaper to find what temperature it's going to be today. Like, you don't want someone to have gone crazy and wild with this graphic and trying to show you like the emotion behind the temperature. Like, no, can you just tell me the number, or can you just show me how it's changing throughout the day? Don't be creative there. Like, just go with what works. But if they do have a lot of time, maybe they will have more time to decode something more novel. So then you're kind of leaning more towards, okay, this is a good time. And then the second question is, how much do I need to capture attention? So if, again, this is something where it's a CEO looking at, you know, some overarching numbers, right? They, you don't need to capture their attention necessarily. Maybe it's just like, can you just give me the number? Like, I'm already paying attention. I'm looking at this slide. Just give me the number. But if you're, you know, creating a graphic for social media and you need to capture attention, okay, well, we're going to have to probably be a little bit more novel in this situation. So yes, let's try to be a little bit more creative. And then, have there been any struggles conveying this in the past? So if you have this particular bar chart that you have on your dashboard and everyone just always gets it, the analysts love it, why spend time reinventing it? But if it's like there and nobody gets this, like this is always causing us problems, okay, let's spend some time, experiment with new things. And that would be a good use of our time. And then the last question I think about is, how much time or resources do I as the designer have? If I got to create something by tomorrow, like I don't have time to experiment and then test it, because if you are doing something more novel, you do need to test it to make sure you're hitting the mark. So if you don't have any time for that, like that's just the long and short of it. You just have to, go with what has worked in the past. So I ask myself those questions and I kind of rate them from kind of like low to high and then sort of average them out. And that, you know, like you don't have to be exact with it and like with your calculator, but just kind of putting a number along those scales and then averaging it out, it's going to tell you ish, you know, okay, this is a good time where you just need to stick with what works. Please just build the dashboard and do the thing, do with what we've always done. Or, okay, I think we might actually be able to spend a week. Can you go spend a week? You have a week to kind of try out some ideas. And then by Friday, let's look through three options. try to do something outside the box, and then we can try to test it. So that's how I approach it. I think having practical tools like that are going to help you get buy-in to using extra time to be creative.
Such a good framework.
I love your point about having a culture of creativity. Mm. And in your work, Allie, have you encountered particular organizations that seem to do this really well? Or could you at least give us more details about what a culture of creativity could look like, not just at the individual level, but maybe at the structural level, at the administrative level?
Yeah, I think at the team that I currently work on at Data Literacy, we're a very small team. There's four people, including me. And I was just thinking the other day how I really, the way that it's structured works really well for my creativity. And part of that is trusting someone that they're going to get done what they need to get done. So having that discussion that I just talked about, you know, will help orient people. Okay, this is the time to experiment, or this is the time to just kind of do the task. So being on the same page about that, like, okay, I'm spending a week experimenting with this thing, and now my manager has a different expectation of me. They're not just thinking like, she didn't do anything this week. Like, she was so unproductive this week. Like, in her status report, she literally did nothing. It seems like I did nothing, but actually I was experimenting with a lot of different visual forms, or I was testing something, or gathering information from other people, some maybe either inspiration or feedback on my idea, which might sound not productive. Like, I didn't actually get anywhere near showing a final product, but I was being productive. So being on the same page and allowing time for roadblocks, I feel like that's like the crux of creating a culture where it's okay to not have like a whole bunch of check marks on your to-do list. It's okay to have taken the time to experiment and doing things that seem unproductive. So like things like going for a walk, it sounds like that's unproductive, and maybe your manager wouldn't like that you are taking an hour in the middle of the day and going for a walk, but that's really central to the to creativity. It's super important to be able to like squeeze out the sponge, right? Like, so if you think about your brain as a sponge, when you're doing dishes, you have to squeeze out the sponge a lot because it just gets too full and it's ineffective. When you are creating new ideas, trying to connect the dots, you need to squeeze out your sponge to kind of clear it out and being like, allow your brain to do that kind of behind the scenes work of connecting the dots for you. So it seems like maybe you're not sitting in front of your desk being productive, but you actually are getting closer and closer to that idea. So knowing that there are different approaches for creativity, because if you want just like a perfect circle, 1,000 times over, you know, get the machine to do it, right? But if you want something that's like occasionally spectacular, you have to approach creativity's natural human rhythm. Like, it's, you're human, and these are things that aren't going to just come like you're a machine. You have to like care for it. You have to take a break. You have to get feedback from other people. It's just kind of a messy, inefficient process.
Yeah, I agree with you, Allie. I think the culture, Michael, to your point, needs to come from the top down, because if you're viewing data and analytics as a service where it's really kind of Jira ticket driven, and it's like, okay, here's the ticket, here's the story points, crank it out, like, what's your throughput? But if you have a manager who understands like, okay, there's different levels, there's keep the lights on, there's growing existing capabilities, then there's building new things, and taking the creative process into account and supporting you through that, then I think it's much better to have that creative support from the top down rather than the bottom up. I think that's always going to be a struggle if there's a throughput analytics as a service culture, just keeping the lights on, trying to change that to creativity rather than a senior level leader coming in and saying, okay, we need to keep the lights on. That's throughput, but we also want to grow and build. And that takes more creative process, which, you know, you say it might be inefficient, but it's like inefficient in what way? Inefficient in a Jira ticket perspective, sure, but not in a progress perspective.
Yeah. Or if like you ultimately get what you want and it's like better than just what you were going to do and do the standard way. I mean, that's a high reward. It's just that you don't know You don't know when it's going to come and in what form it's going to come. So that makes a lot of people nervous. I mean, rightfully so, you know, if you're trying to keep the lights on, like you said, yeah, the unpredictability kind of hurts. That's a hard thing to swallow for a lot of people.
100%. Yeah, it's all about, for me, just data as a product, because you've got to have that R&D time. As long as you're keeping the lights on, you're growing capabilities, but then you have to have that build, that R&D time, that needs to be built into, from the senior leader's perspective, capacity planning. Like if you have a throughput crunch and you have zero capacity to have this creative process, that's a senior leader issue. They need to figure that out and reprioritize.
Yeah. And it's hard too, as someone who is part of that team, if you are having to be so highly productive and just like you're executing time, it never gives you that extra time to just play, experiment, rest, connect those dots. So you're just going to burn out.
100%. Well, this has been incredibly insightful. I can't wait to finish your book, and I'm going to buy it for my team. I'm going to buy it for you too, Michael, so you can be more creative.
Well, I think creativity could thrive here because I work in academia and we have no problem with inefficiency.
Yeah, that's true. That's a fact.
You have 6 months to sign this document. Okay. Archive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, shared governance. Let's vote on it. Should we sign the document? Yeah.
Have a committee meeting about it.
Allie, where can people find you?
Let's see. I'm very active on LinkedIn, Allie Torben. And also you can go to chartsparkbook.com and everywhere, you know, that will show you everywhere you can get the book. And if your listeners would like a bonus chapter of the book, you can go to chartsparkbook.com/bonus. And I've made a bonus chapter where it's all about what I would say in different creative situations. So if I am presenting a creative idea to a client, how exactly I would lay that out, what exactly I would say when I'm responding to negative feedback. So there's 4 different scenarios in that chapter that I found very useful in my day-to-day. So hopefully your listeners will find it useful too.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And we'll link the book in the description.
Great.
Thanks, Michael, so much for Allie, having me. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thanks.
Right. You too.